This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
There is a lot of interest in extinction lately. Species from birds to bees are disappearing, and we hope humans are not next. Where are the limits? When is it too late? Daniel Rothman is a professor of geophysics at MIT and co-director of the Lorenz Center. His 2017 paper, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System, well, it was a startling new look at the role of carbon in the ocean. Now he's published what I'll call Part 2, with the somewhat obscure title, Characteristic Disruptions of an Excitable Carbon Cycle. If you're wondering how it all could end, this quiet MIT mathematician and theoretical scientist has a kind of rude warning for us all. We last spoke in November 2017. Daniel Rothman, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Well, we need to refresh what I'll call your foundational paper for this series, Thresholds of Catastrophe in the Earth System. Would you mind walking us through how you came to look at records of ancient carbon in the seabed and what you consider the role of the ocean and the atmosphere to be?
Sure. The study began quite literally with a couple of simple observations. The observations, which I think many people are broadly familiar with, there are on the order of five, the so-called Big Five mass extinctions that are sort of well ingrained in the public consciousness now, such as the end Cretaceous and the end Permian extinction. And each of these major extinction events are accompanied by a significant change in the carbon cycle, which we can see in the rock record. On the other hand, there are many events, so-called paleoclimate events, in which we can see roughly similar changes in the carbon cycle, but there is no major extinction. And so I basically was curious about whether this idea of roughly similar could be quantified, because it wasn't obvious that they were indeed similar and that there might be a difference. And so I asked myself whether there was some difference between the kinds of perturbations that we that sort of have often occurred in the geologic past and the ones that are somehow special, meaning that they're especially destructive or catastrophic, such as mass extinction. And that's the sort of basic question, but there's another component to this, and that has to do with what's going on today. And it's well known that the CO2 is being effectively injected into the atmosphere now at unprecedented rates, and a large portion of that is going into the oceans. And so the rate is very fast, much faster than anything we've seen in the past, including past mass extinctions. But it's not a priori obvious that the rate at which things change is the particular variable that we should be addressing. And so I wanted to know what could be said about that. And the specific issue enters the 2017 paper, but the one I addressed in much more detail in the most recent paper is how to look at these past events, which occur at timescales of tens of thousands and sometimes hundreds of thousands of years, how they become relevant, or if they are relevant at all, to understanding what's going on now at a timescale of effectively 100 years, meaning the timescale of industrial emissions.
And you made a model that kind of stretches in two different directions, whether it's the rate of carbon getting in there or the amount of time it takes it to get there. But to do those calculations, you first need to kind of picture, and we all need to picture, a kind of trade-off in carbon between the atmosphere and storage in the oceans. There's a sort of balanced loop. Do you want to talk about how that works? I mean, some flows out of the rivers and some goes into the seabed and some goes back. How does it work?
So you're asking about the carbon cycle in general, I suppose. The carbon cycle is, on the one hand, a delightfully simple beast, even though it's very complex and when you get into the details. And it's this loop you speak of is just a loop between photosynthesis, which takes CO2 out of the atmosphere, or in the case of marine plankton, out of seawater. And that's what we call primary production. And the back end of the loop, or the back reaction, is what we call respiration. That is, organisms like us, which metabolize the organic matter, which ultimately derives from plants or from organisms that consume the plants, And these organisms, known as consumer organisms, basically metabolize the organic carbon and bring it back to CO2 by an oxidation process. So it's a loop between taking CO2 out of the atmosphere by plants and returning CO2 to the atmosphere by consuming organisms. Many of these organisms are not necessarily animals like us. They're just microbial. And the microbial organisms can become especially interesting in the oceans because they not only operate at very fast time scales near the sea surface, but they operate at very slow time scales near the sea bottom.
And your studies show that this system tends to be stable in the ocean for long periods of time, if I understand it.
Well, yes. I mean, it's sort of commonly assumed that it more or less is stable. That's not necessarily based on any evidence that is solid, but a feeling that it goes back to the, ancient notion of nature being in balance. And so if nature is in balance, then, the system must be stable. Otherwise, why would it be balanced, right? That's the naive statement. And so, yes, it's sort of stable, and indeed, if you now look at the geologic record of changes in the carbon cycle, what you see is that it does go through long periods of stability. But what interests me, and was of interest in when I wrote those papers, is the fact that these long periods of stability are punctuated by relatively short periods of basically some type of perturbation, some type, we call them events, and the events bring the system away from its typical state, and then it returns back to its typical state. And so there's a physical / mathematical question one can ask as to whether those events are the result of an instability, and the instability is, one of my favorite examples of an unstable process would be a lawnmower that runs on grass. All right, it just sort of goes out of control because makes it run even faster. But that's a question that ultimately one needs to, with respect to the carbon cycle or any system, one needs to examine carefully. And just because there's a positive feedback in the system, so to give you an example of a positive feedback that many people are familiar with would be permafrost or peat. As the climate warms, more organic matter is remineralized in the thawing permafrost, and that raises CO2 levels even higher, which then feeds back positively into the system. That's scary by itself. However, it doesn't necessarily establish that the system is unstable because we don't know what we have to evaluate what the negative feedbacks are to the process too. And so this is where the importance of mathematical models comes in, because with mathematical models you can write down a kind of idealization of the process and ask questions of, given these feedbacks, when, if at all, does it become unstable?
Right. It sounds like it's almost a system where once it begins to wobble, it may resettle into a stable state, or it may just fall over. And maybe you could talk to us about what you mean by an excitable carbon cycle in the new paper.
Thanks for asking. So I divided the world up into two a moment ago, stable and unstable. Right? Excitable is actually somewhere in the middle. And an excitable system works in the following way. If you push it a little bit beyond a threshold, then it acts as if it's becoming unstable. So it makes, basically, it fires what we call a kind of spike. That is, there's a major change, a major perturbation in the system. But then it returns back to its point of stability all by itself. So from a technical or physical point of view, the system is always stable because the same initial state is returned after it goes through this so-called, if you wish, an excursion into, another territory. In the case of the carbon cycle, it's ocean acidification. After the ocean acidifies, then it returns to its previous state. And so technically it turns out to be stable even though it goes through this excitation. And for some of your listeners, the following analogy may be of interest. Excitable systems were first studied in the mid-20th century by biophysicists who are interested in how neurons work. So if you inject a sufficiently strong current into a neuron, then it fires what's called a neuron spike. but if it's not strong enough, it doesn't fire a spike. And that's how neurons work, and this has been a well-studied phenomenon since the mid-20th century. It's developed into an entire sort of sub-discipline of biophysics and applied mathematics. And my paper falls within that tradition. The models are different. They come from a different place, but they exhibit a range of behavior that falls within that class.
The most famous mass death event in the past 500 million years was the end-Permian extinction around 250 million years ago. Did you find any sort of evidence that that could have been the kind of excursion that you're talking about?
That's a very interesting question. So here's how it plays out. I made a database. We live in an age of big data. Big data in this subject means 31 events. All right, so you can put them all on the table on one page of a journal, but it's a lot of work, finding all of that. So there's 31 events, roughly. I mean, that's exactly what I studied, which are global, perturbations, if you wish, of the carbon cycle during the last 540 million years. Right. Now, of those 31 events, roughly half of them plot out, and when you plot them as a function of the size, that is the extent of the perturbation versus the time scale at which they occur, and what you see is that they exhibit a characteristic flux of carbon being mobilized in the system. And when I say characteristic flux, today we're putting in like 8 or 9 gigatons of CO2 into the atmosphere. This is a much slower characteristic flux, but it's basically gigatons of CO2 being remobilized into the system per unit time. So the question is, what makes these special? Why are there half of the events just lining up in this one sort of special way? And so that accounts for the obscure title of the paper you just referred to as the characteristic events. That's what I call them. They're characteristic events, and I refer to them as characteristic because they have the signature of a excitation. That is a characteristic excitation. They have the signature of the system itself rather than a mechanism that's making things change. There's no way to sensibly attribute them to methane or volcanism or changes in whatever you wish to invoke, because they're all behaving in the same way. So why would they be subject to different types of stressors? So, but the question you asked is about the end-Permian extinction. That's the worst of them all. Greater than 90% of species are thought to have died. And when you look at that carbon cycle event, that's way larger than all of the others. And when I say larger, I mean its flux is stronger. It has a flux of CO2, which is about 5 times the characteristic flux that I was referring to earlier. And so what is that? So my best guess at the moment, following the reasoning I've been recounting in the past few minutes, I would say that these are excitations that have been pushed way beyond their threshold. And the likely culprit is volcanism in Siberia, known as Siberian Trap Volcanism. And that raises an entirely other question is about the role of volcanism in mass extinctions.
But what you said just a minute ago was kind of exciting to me because it causes us to make a real rethink. Instead of thinking about the ocean as a passive recorder that just mirrors back what's happened in major geo events, whether it's volcanoes or an asteroid hitting or something, you're saying, no, wait a minute, this is a system that within itself can make big changes that could affect the whole process of the Earth.
Right. You hit that nail on its head. That's exactly what's going on. That's one of the more important points that I was trying to make. As the system contains enough complexity of its own to engage in these abrupt events. And so the role of a theoretical paper like mine is to show how that could occur. And because it's mathematical theory, it doesn't really pin down a precise mechanism. It basically provides examples of how such a thing would behave, and then it makes comparisons to observational data to show that indeed the observational data is consistent with the theory.
But as you said, about half the cases of warming that you find in the big record, it gets a lot hotter and things don't go extinct. And,
that's right.
You know, I'm thinking about the Paleo-Eocene thermal maximum,
exactly.
55 million years ago.
Yeah, that's the poster child here. Absolutely. It's a very significant paleoclimate event. It's a very significant ocean acidification event. And there are some species of benthic foraminifera, little critters that live at the bottom of the sea that went extinct. But it's nothing like the so-called Big Five.
Okay, now, here's the key question. I feel like I'm asking my doctor whether I have cancer or not. How can we know, if the current rush towards a hotter world will be a time of mass extinction or not?
Yeah, and the doctor looks at you and he says, "We don't know." So I tried to address this question in my paper, and basically my goal was to develop a rational framework in which to address the issue, and the framework looks like this. It is indeed the case that there seems to be a kind of critical rate, but the critical rate of change beyond which things go haywire. That critical rate of change is the characteristic rate I was speaking of earlier, and that's a typical excitation. And so the issue is, you know, how much does it take to get to that point? At least that's what I was trying to address. Not so much how much does it take to get over it, but how much does it take to get to it. And so there's this notion of excitation that I was referring to earlier. You need to get beyond a threshold. And the threshold can be cast as a kind of critical flux of carbon that's required to put into the system. And so the bottom line is this. If the event is playing out over a slow time scale, that critical flux is not very large. But if it's playing out over a fast time scale, that critical flux is very large. And indeed, the critical flux scales, this is now me speaking mathematically, it scales like 1 over the time scale. And that basically says the following, and this is a result in the paper which I'm quite pleased with. If you go to the extinction that killed the dinosaurs, there's very recent results that lead to an estimate of the amount of CO2 that was injected into the atmosphere, not by the bolide impact in Yucatan, which is now widely familiar to people, but by the Deccan Trap volcanism in India, which also occurred at the same time. So setting aside the question of what caused the extinction, the volcanism, you know, and or the bolide impact, we have an estimate of how much CO2 was added just before, when I say just before, order 10,000 years before the KT and Cretaceous extinction. And so that turns out that the flux of that is sort of 100 times less strong than the flux of CO2 into the atmosphere today. That's a factor of 100 smaller. So that seems minuscule compared to what's going on today. Or you might think that what's going on today is absolutely enormous compared to what went on then. On the other hand, today's perturbation of the system is going on over 100 years as opposed to 10,000 years. So there's that factor of 100 again. And because the time scale is 100 times shorter, but the flux is 100 times greater, they turn out to cancel each other. So today's flux, today's, you know, basically anthropogenic flux, turns out to be roughly equivalent to the flux of CO2 that was observed, you know, just before the Cretaceous extinction, but equivalent in the sense of being able to get over a threshold that will excite the system. And so that, to me, was a nice comparison because it shows how the present-day emissions can be effectively rescaled to put them in the perspective of the past, or vice versa, which is actually what would interest most people, how we can interpret the past so it becomes relevant to the present.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about a limit to our carbon pollution hidden in the ocean. Our guest is Dr. Daniel Rothman from MIT. So, through your calculations, you were able to arrive at approximately the amount of carbon that we could still stick up there in the atmosphere before we reached this threshold, and maybe even a date when the threshold would be reached at our current rate. Do you want to talk about that, please?
Sure. It's basically several hundred gigatons of CO2 going into the oceans. Let's call it 300 to 400 as a round number, given some reasonable error bar. And when currently human activities have put in on the order of 150 gigatons of carbon into the ocean, so about twice that. And that level, by any reasonable estimate, will be reached sometime this century, right? And beyond that, that's, given the analysis of the empirical record and given our understanding that we've developed of how the system works, that's the amount of CO2 that, when added to the oceans, risks exciting one of these ocean acidification events, and the ocean acidification being a likely kill mechanism for major extinctions in the past. Now, there's an important caveat to this. All of this is about the oceans, and which is also where our record of past extinctions primarily lies, and it's also where our database lies in ocean bottom sediments. But events in the ocean play out at slow time scales. And by that I mean is that the oceans have a natural damping time scale of about 10,000 years. So if we acidify the oceans today, that acidification pulse, if you could instantaneously acidify the oceans, that would basically be neutralized after about 10,000 years. So what that means physically is that anything we do, that is, if we perturb the system beyond what I'm calling the excitation threshold, the runaway effect that would excite would play out over that damping time scale, about 10,000 years before it is basically neutralized. And so it's not that, one day we go over the limit and the next day everything is over. It's a process. And what happens during those 10,000 years is kind of unknown. I mean, my work has tried to address some of it, but it leaves many questions unanswered.
Of course, my human bias, I'm going to say, well, if it takes another 10,000 years, we may be on another planet by then, or we may have killed ourselves off with something else like nuclear weapons. I mean,
yeah. Well, the first 100 won't be nice.
Okay, so we could feel some effects pretty quickly.
Absolutely. I mean, when you back away from this work, what you see is that my analysis is, in a sense, not coming to a terribly different conclusion than a lot of very different analyses are coming to. That beyond a certain amount, there's a lot of unpredictable things that might happen. And by examining the ancient record, I'm trying to figure out what that amount is, given these rescaling factors that I talked about. And it's kind of interesting that it doesn't turn out to be a whole lot different than, a whole lot of other calculations about, when the various tipping points might kick in. And that's in the popular parlance, that what we're talking about here is a kind of tipping point phenomenon.
But you're looking not really at temperature that's going to burn us out. You're looking at ocean acidification. So that's a whole other aspect.
Yeah, which is not going to be helped by the weather becoming warmer.
No.
Becoming warmer at all. But that's right. I'm looking at purely the consequences of adding CO2 to the oceans.
And it occurs to me that your theory can blow up one of the key arguments for cooling the planet with geoengineering, because proponents say, well, we'll shoot some sulfates into the air, it'll reflect some sun, it'll cool things off while we figure out something else, we'll keep burning fossil fuels. But your research says temperature isn't the key anyway, because if you keep adding all that carbon to the ocean, you still go into a possible disastrous mass extinction eventually.
That's about 99% correct. I would just disagree with temperature isn't the key anyway. What I'm saying is CO2, as you just observed, is very important. So is temperature. The larger point is this. By making the types of perturbations that we are, collectively are doing today, that is, injecting a lot of CO2 into the system, we're not just changing the climate. We're doing many, many other things, and these things have consequences. That it's so basically what I'm just trying to, what I'm trying to say is warming isn't the only thing going on here, and effects on ecosystems are obviously a big piece of the puzzle.
Is there any sign that people like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change or other policy people are starting to pick up on your paper and add this to our reasons why we've got to get going now?
You know, those kinds of questions are hard to answer. Right? You know, I feel like a well-recognized scientist, so I'm not going to tell you that nobody's paying any attention, but also like a lot of well-recognized scientists, I also feel that I could probably do with a little bit more recognition. So I don't really know how to address that, other than to say I think it's inevitable that organizations like the IPCC will start paying more attention to what was once called the unknown unknowns, all right, than things like climate sensitivity, which is something that's relatively easy to address.
Well, I think people like the Extinction Rebellion movement should pay attention to this too, because it's a bigger part of their story. So are you going to keep going with this line of research with more papers to come?
Yeah. So, you know, there's these 31 events to explain. I've taken some very gross view of them. Those events in the deep past, which are even greater, which have to do with, for example, the oxygenation of the atmosphere or the possibility that the whole Earth froze over. The whole Earth freezing over doesn't seem like a warming event, but it may be associated with warming events that occurred before such episodes. I'm referring to the so-called snowball Earth events. And then there are these garden variety paleoclimate events, which I referred to earlier, and a whole bunch of them occur in a period known as the Eocene, the one that followed the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum that you referred to earlier. And they're a very nice place to look, because they all have this characteristic type of behavior, but it's not really clear what's really making that system go. To make it concrete, I've provided a theory of how an excitable carbon cycle could work, but I haven't pinned down what the mechanism of getting over the threshold is, and that would be of a lot of interest.
Daniel, as we wrap up, just out of curiosity, what else are you working on these days?
Oh, a variety of things. I've spent several decades now, three working on problems of fluid mechanics, which are very different, in which I study pattern formation and on geological problems, for instance, the shape of rivers. That's a major component of my work. But I also maybe should point back to something I just mentioned a moment ago, something that's going to occupy a lot of my attention in the coming few years, is trying to explain why the atmosphere has the oxygen that it has. And this will amount to explaining what we call the great oxygenation event, which occurred about 2.5 billion years ago. Somehow oxygen accumulated, and the way it accumulated and the way it stayed in the atmosphere has something to do with some imperfections in that loop of the carbon cycle we just talked about earlier. So it's kind of curious why these are effectively feedback errors. And the feedback errors, this is a whole other subject, but the feedback errors are responsible for why there's a bunch of free oxygen in the atmosphere. And I'd like to figure out how that works.
It would be handy to know why it is we can breathe, or why
exactly
we even exist as multicellular organisms. So that's all handy. We've been speaking with MIT Professor Daniel Rothman, and you can find links to all the science we just talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Daniel, it's always great to talk with you. Thank you, and come back again.
Thanks very much, Alex. I've enjoyed it.
The terrible fire season in Australia continues. Among the victims, one of the most lovable animals, the koala bear. These vegetarians depend on leaves from the eucalyptus trees, which burn like oily flares in the fires. Forbes' Ted Nace reports on November 23rd, quote, "The chairman of the Australian Koala Foundation, Deborah Tabbert, estimates that over 1,000 koalas have been killed from the fires and that 80% of their habitat has been destroyed," end quote. Experts say the iconic little bears are now functionally extinct. the population has dwindled below the numbers needed to keep reproducing new generations and could easily be wiped out by disease or further fires. Perhaps you have seen the Guardian video of a brave woman running into the fire to save a koala with her blouse and water bottle. It is heartbreaking in the extreme. If we cannot control ourselves and our emissions, we are entering the time of saying goodbye to many of our storybook creatures, and countless living things that we don't see will also disappear. There are two great crises in nature today, climate change and mass extinction of living things. We cannot lose sight of either one as we struggle to rearrange our great hunger for more and more space and power from the limited resources on this little planet. That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.